Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
You see it's a good beat. aqualung, my friend. Don't you start away uneasy, you poor old sod. You see, it's only me.
Aqualung, Jethro Tull, from their fourth studio album, also called Aqualung. Surprisingly enough, released on March 1971. Sold more than 7 million units worldwide and the band's most successful album.
Who are Jethro Tull?
Well,
what is it? Who is? Who are?
Who are?
Is there a band?
Yeah, I mean, iconic. And it was really, they were sort of like intelligent rock. The first thing I heard about them was that, you know, I saw pictures of Ian Anderson jumping around on one leg with a flute, very bizarrely. You know, he's a bizarre character. The whole band was very bizarre. But, I mean, you've actually been looking into this a bit, haven't you?
Well, I have, because, you know, it's really weird, but there are a few bands that I know of, but I don't know their music. But when I hear their music, I go, oh, I think I do, you know? Because they formed in Blackpool, of all places, in 1967.
Yeah, I knew the Blackpool. Very
that
dodgy.
Was great. So when I look into who they are, if you don't know who Jethro Tull are, they were a unique phenomenon in popular music history. And they first achieved commercial success in 1969 with a folk-tinged kind of blues album called Stand Up, which went to number one in the UK charts. Get in there. And they've got a mix of hard rock, folk melodies, blues licks, surreal, impossibly dense lyrics, and overall profundity, and defied... It's true, I know.
I love the word profundity.
Overall profundity. Because it's got the foot sound, isn't it?
Yeah.
Profundity. But it defied sort of like an easy analysis. But basically, it didn't dissuade fans from giving them 11 gold and 5 platinum albums. But at the same time, the critics didn't really take them seriously, and they were off the cutting edge of popular music by the end of the 70s, so it says here in All Music. But they was also saying that no record store in the country would want to be without multiple copies of each of their most popular albums. There was Benefit, Aqualung, Thickest Brick, Living in the Past, or their best of compilations, and few people would never knowingly ignore any new releases. So of their contemporaries, is to finalise this, to put this into context, only Yes could claim a similar degree of success. And yet Yes had gone through lots of different shifts in sound and memberships by the 90s, whereas Jethro Tull, they'd remained the same. They'd just gone through 21 different members.
Yeah, well, I think the thing with Jethro Tull is that they were very folk-based. There's a lot of acoustic guitar in there. I mean, I was never a big fan of Martin Barr, the guitar player. I'm not a big fan. It always seems a bit wooden to me, and I'm very rude. I'm sorry, Martin. But it's like, it always sounded a bit wooden. And on that track, what I haven't noticed, I haven't heard for a long, long, long time, is the drums. Because the toms, they sound completely out of time on that on that beginning bit, it really, you stick cans on and you listen to it, and they're all over the place, and it's like throwing you off rhythm. And, you know, whether it's by accident or design, because he does the same thing all the way through, so it wasn't a mistake.
No, yeah.
So it's throwing you off balance, and I think that's something about the psychic thing they were trying to do. They were trying to, with the lyric and everything, were trying to push people off balance, because it was a very edgy subject, as it is now, you know? And this was recorded at Chris Blackwell's Island Studios. I think it was originally called Basin Street Studios. And
yeah.
They had a Helios console in there. Like, was it Strawberry? You know, I know I'm going off on consoles again. But it is interesting that they didn't particularly like the studio, did they?
No, because Led Zeppelin were recording at the same time, actually, Led Zepp 4. Mm. And they were, and Jethro Tull were in the bigger studio, but they found it quite cold and quite echoey, and they didn't. It didn't sort of, it wasn't conducive to creative sort of output for them, I think. They struggled.
I can imagine, actually, because they're more of an acoustic, they'd want a more close environment, because yeah. With all those acoustic guitars, I mean, if you've got a big rock and roll band, and I wouldn't say echoey, but, you know, if you've got a big space,
yeah.
you've got somewhere for the sound to sort of expand and breathe, if you like, you know. Yeah. You know, I'm not particularly a fan of big echo studios, but you know what I'm saying. But perhaps then, because they were more folk based, they were used to playing more, you know, in a contained environment.
It's an odd thing as well, because when I was listening to the music, it evokes sort of like tapestries on wall and dust for some reason, and it almost feels like it's an old Polaroid that hasn't, for me, it's such a snapshot in time. And I personally can't really get off on it. I can hear elements of Wishbone Ash in there.
Mm.
And I could almost hit as well. And I just double-checked while I was listening to this song really in depth. There was a little bit like Black Sabbath as well, just towards the end with a...
Great riff.
It was Black Sabbath were 1 year before that. So they came out in 1970, and this was in 71.
Mm.
So I could feel there were some influences in there. And that's really nice to know in a way, because it's almost like, you know, it's like, you know, when you can taste a recipe, you go, I think we got some almonds in there and some vanilla, you know,
yeah.
It's like really nice. And even though I don't want to compare, I also like to just shut up and listen to the song and how it makes me feel.
Well, that was engineered by John Burns as well, who went on to work with Genesis and
right.
You know, Lamb Lies Down Butter and all that. I think he did quite a few of the Genesis albums, and a very interesting, you know, path that the and a trajectory that took Jethro Tull. But again, it's not one of my favourite bands, but I think would be rude not to have it on the show because of that time, because it really gives you a different flavour of that early 70s thing. This is like the West Wing of it, you know?
So true, you
know. And like Yes, and when you brought up Yes before, because they were much more proggy, more electronic, you know, they had a lot more synthesizers in there, of course, and stuff, and Steve Howe's guitar playing a lot jazzier. The bass was a lot more dramatic, you know, with Chris Squire. And it was completely different. But it's interesting that you brought the comparison there.
And the other thing I really like is that the odd lyric was like jumping out at me, like there was snot and nose.
Yeah.
And it's like dog end. And I like the my favourite line is deep sea diver sound.
Yeah. Well, please.
Mystery man came over and he said, I'm out of sight. He said, for a nominal service charge, I could reach Nirvana tonight. If I was ready, willing, and able to pay him his regular fee, he would drop all the rest of his pressing affairs and devote his attention to me. But I said,
look here, brother, who you down?
Now who you jiving with that cosmic debris?
Look here, brother, don't you waste your time on me.
The mystery man got nervous and he fidgeted around a bit. He reached in the pocket of his mystery robe and he whipped out a shaving kit. Now I thought it was a razor and a can of foaming goo, but he told me right then when the top popped open there was nothing his box won't do with the oil. Aphrodite and the dust of the Grand Wazoo. He said, you might not believe this, little fellow, but it'll cure your asthma too. And I said, and your preparations and ram it up your snout.
But I got a crystal ball,
he said, and held it to the light. So I snatched it all away from him, and I showed him how to do it right.
I wrapped the newspaper around my head so I looked like I was dead. I said some mumble jumble then, I told him he was going to sleep. He couldn't even make a sound. I proceeded to tell him his future then, as long as he was hanging around. I said,
the price of meat has just gone up and your old lady has just gone down.
Now is that a real poncho or is that a Sears poncho? Don't you know you could make more money as a butcher? So don't you waste your time on me.
Don't waste it.
Cosmic Debris, Frank Zappa. Who else? That was from his 18th album, Apostrophe, released on April the 22nd in 1974 on Discreet Records.
Well, is that a real poncho? Is that a Sears poncho? That is a great line. I mean, there's the lyric in that is just fantastic. The dust of the Grand Wazoo, you know, and this, like the sound effects after it. The thing that gets me about that is the quality of the recording as well, because the vocals right up front, it's a beautiful recorded thing. And you know, when you listen to that and compare it with Aqualung, which was only two years before, there's definitely a massive difference between what was happening in England at that time and what was happening in America, because America had really, you know, it's a lot smoother and, you know, richer sound in the whole thing. The compression's lovely and the musicianship is astronomically good. I mean, that glockenspiel, I mean, it is unbelievable. And it's, but it's through the whole album, you get that brrr, and it's sort of ridiculous, but it's beautiful, because you just don't expect that on a rock and roll record, do you?
No, I was actually I just looked on a search engine about when video arcade games were actually invented, because it felt like he was doing an arcade game with my head. And you know, you're talking about the vocals up close and really up close. He's actually scared me a little bit, because he's so close in my ears that I can almost smell what he had for dinner. You know, that kind of, it's a little bit uncomfortable. You can almost like the salivation in his mouth, and just like even just the skin on the edge of his lips. It's kind of, he's like so close to my head. It's a bit in your face. And then he kind of lightens up that, because it becomes a little bit sinister. And then you suddenly there's doo-doo-doo-doo.
That's it. Ruth Underwood. I mean, she's an amazing player, because to do all that live as well. And when you see him from that era doing it live, it is even more frightening. absolutely terrifying, you know, because they're so accurate. And Ainsley Dunbar played on that, George Duke, on this album. We've talked about it before because we had a few weeks ago, we had Nanook Rubs It, didn't we, from that album.
I love
which
that.
Is fantastic, you know.
I love it so much. And do you know what? I just love the fact we're just taking odd songs and putting them in the show now and again, because it's like having like a sherbet sweet. It's like, get in there. This is something completely different. And it really just changes your head up and makes me really stupid, like goon-like. I feel like a goon. You know what I mean?
I haven't heard that expression for a long time.
I just feel like getting up to mischief.
Unless you're talking about politicians. But... Oh, no, that's great. Right, a goon. I forgot what I was going to say now. It's,
it's quite funny, though, because the whole song is like making fun of those who market and sell cosmic wisdom, you know, and it is a complete and utter.
What I love about that as well is that it's basically a sort of 12-bar blues, really, you know, and it is, but it's that end bit where it comes, you know, and the timing is fantastic, because to come up with a different turnaround at the end of a 12-bar blues is, you know, is tricky, because everybody's older, but I've never heard one like that. The only track that I've heard that sort of, that really messes around with the 12-bar blues, and we've already played that, was that Robert Palmer Trick Bag off the Riptide album, if you remember that.
Yeah.
And that was really weird. It's a really weird time. But that, I love that turnaround, because it just sort of does something to me, and it makes me smile every time, and it makes me just, it's in awe of actually writing it, and also performing it with such slick beauty, you know?
I think Zappa is like wake-up powder for your ears, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know what I mean, though? Because he certainly gets your attention. And he just completely, like, puts a syringe of lime juice throughout your head and you just go bang! And it's
but
like,
you could imagine him using flu powder, couldn't you? Like, from Harry Potter.
Exactly.
You could imagine him just disappearing.
I reckon
like
it's the two
Wizard.
Brothers, like, with all their blinking, like,
the Weasleys.
That's what it is.
That's what it is. That's who Frank Zappa was. He's probably not dead. He's probably just in somebody's chimney somewhere. He's gone up the flu.
That wouldn't surprise me at all. Do you know what was really interesting as well? And another bit of kind of trivia here, but I didn't realise. But apparently, Jack Bruce played bass on Apostrophe on the actual title track of the album.
Yeah.
Right. So when you look into it, that's not necessarily the case, right? Because Frank Zappa said, well, they were having this jam thing. It just happened that Jack Bruce was a friend of the drummer, Jim Gordon. But he found it very difficult. Zappa found it very difficult to play with Jack Bruce because he said he found him too busy. And he said he doesn't really want to play the bass in terms of root functions. I think he has other things on his mind.
Well, that's
isn't
right.
Isn't that interesting? And it's so true.
Yeah.
So you've got a busy gut too, because they were both leads, weren't they, really? Because Jack Bruce just took the bass and made it something else. Now, because there's always two sides of the coin, this is the lovely thing about this, right? So Jack Bruce's side of his understanding of what happened was that he said, I turned up in a New York studio with his cello, right? Because he was a cellist as well as a bass player. And he was listening to Zappa's music and he thought it was pretty awful. And he didn't know what to do with himself. And then Frank said to him, hey, listen, I'd really like you to play a sound like this. Whang! And so Jeffrey said, so I did what he asked me to do. And I made this sound. Whang! And he said that was it. That was my input into Frank Zappa's most popular record.
It's 4 in the morning, the end of December. I'm writing you now just to see if you're better. New York is cold, but I like where I'm living. There's music on Clinton Street all through the evening. I hear that you're building your house deep in the desert. Are you living for nothing now? Hope you're keeping some kind of record. Yes. And Jane came by with a lock of your hair. She said that you gave it to her that night when you planned to go clear. Did you ever go clear? Ah, the last time we saw ya, you looked so much older. Your famous blue raincoat was torn at the shoulder. You'd been to the station to meet every train, but she never turned up. I mean, Lily Marlene. So you treated someone to a flake of your life. And when she got home, she was nobody's wife. Well, I see you there with a rose in your teeth. One gypsy thief. Well, I see James awake. She sends her regards. You stood in my way. And if you ever come by here, be it for Jane or for me, I want you to know your enemy is sleeping. I want you to know your woman is free. Yes. And thanks for the trouble you took from her eyes. I thought it was there for good, so I never really tried. And Jane
Jennifer Warnes, Famous Blue Raincoat, from a sixth studio album, Famous Blue Raincoat, the songs of Leonard Cohen, which was released in 1986. Emotional?
Yeah.
We're both crying, actually. That... Leonard Cohen is an incredible, or was an incredible songwriter, and he did such amazing things. And when he sings himself, he's got a certain thing, an atmosphere and all that, and he was a poet. But that interpretation by Jennifer Warnes there is one of the finest vocal performances I think I've heard in a long, long, long time. The sound of the whole thing is divine. The only thing that dates is that sax.
Yeah.
But the...
I don't care.
But the bass. The bass. Roscoe Beck, who produced it, the bass player, of course. Roscoe Beck went on to play with Robin Ford. And Robin Ford's actually on that album. Yeah. And that album has got... It's the who's who of the session players in the whole of the United States. There's Colly Ute on drums. There's Roscoe Beck. There's Robin Ford. There's Stevie Ray Vaughan's on there. We've got, you know, an army of incredible musicians. And mixed, finally, by George Massenberger, who's one of my favourite engineers and producers, you know. And it's just divine.
There's a few that, you know, I don't... it's so honest and so beautiful. And, you know, she just makes you shut up because there's something so gorgeous about... so human... I can, it's like I'm standing, I'm listening to somebody who knows what I've been through, and you empathise, and you just think about them going to the train station every night, you know, and it's like all these certain phrases just really, yeah, it's so sad.
And I know, and the diction, and, because she did this, it was Leonard Cohen's idea that she do it, because she was a backing singer with him, wasn't she?
That's right, and it was his idea for the album, and he touted it to a couple of labels like Arista and MCA, and they said no, they didn't want to know. But, I mean, you can understand it, it was nominated for a Grammy Award, can't you, really? But it was weird, you know, because it was like Jennifer Warnes' break in a way, so it got a first taste of critical success, and also it helped to re-establish Leonard Cohen, who was going, his career was going through a bit of an eclipse at the time. But and I found out about the raincoat. I almost don't want to talk because it's just so, such a beautiful song. But the raincoat exists, and apparently he didn't look very good in it. He looked like a spider. But
is that right?
And then what happened was that he took the lining out, and then it got some rips, and he put some, like, you know, as it got worn over the years, he put some leather on it, on the cuffs and stuff, to repair it, and he looked a bit more kind of cool then. And then somebody nicked it from someone's loft, Marianne's loft somewhere in the 80s or something. But it's a Burberry trench coat, and it's, but I kind of, I love that song. And if music is about sharing what it's like to be human, then that just completely melts my heart.
So Australia, to Como, Singapore, to Hong Kong, from the west to the east, from the rich to the poor, Victoria, love them all. Victoria, 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 Victoria.
You're listening to the Supertones Show with Susie Starlight and Simon Campbell of the Starlight Campbell Band.
And that was Victoria by the Kinks. Mm. That was released as the lead single from their seventh studio album, Arthur, or The Decline and Fall of the British Empire, in 1969.
When I hear these songs that were done in these old studios, I'm always taken aback by how distorted the recording is. Because if you listen to it, it's all pretty thick and, you know, everything's slightly overloaded. And I think, and I'm not sure because whether it's the digital, the mastering or whatever, because we don't pull these, we've got the vinyl downstairs of this record, but we don't pull it off that vinyl.
No.
It never sounds quite as distorted. But, you know, but even so, there is a level of distortion there. And apparently this was a Neve desk that recorded this, and when they went up to 8-track, they went to Neve, because the original console was an old Telefunken. Now we like Telefunken consoles.
We used to have a Telefunken TV.
Well, the old consoles are fantastic. They're built like tanks. And actually, next week, we're off to the Netherlands, and we're going to meet our friend Matthias from Vintage City in Germany. Because we're talking about mixing consoles and we're going to get a Cadillac. And funnily enough, going back to...
Wunderschön.
Indeed. Going back to Jethro Tull, the console we're going to be looking at next week is Jethro Tull's old live console, because they wanted to get as good a sound out live as they did in the studio. And they got this great big Cadillac thing, which we're going to have a look at, 1972. So,
I know, I'm really looking forward to it.
It's going to be cool. The thing is, I wonder if we can see if there's any of Ian Anderson's spit anywhere on it, or underpant fluff
thread
or something.
Yeah, something
like that. Yeah, I'm sure it will do.
Sock fluff.
Yeah. Anyway, back to the Kinks.
Yeah, this is the Kinks for me. Oh, they're very boyish, aren't they, really? They were of that time. They weren't as boldly innovative, apparently, as the Beatles, so it says, or as popular as the Rolling Stones or the Who, but they were one of the most influential bands of the British invasion.
Yeah. The lyrics are great, you know, I mean, and some of those, like Waterloo Sunset, I mean, some great, really great songs that they did.
Well,
but again, they were. It's like that Tull thing where they were slightly, to me, like one side. They were a bit left field and slightly out of the whole thing, you know. But they wrote some, you know, fantastic songs. Great live.
I saw Ray Davies at the Bridgewater Hall a few years back now.
Did you
actually?
Know?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was like, I don't know, 20 years ago or something.
Yeah.
And it's quite interesting because then as you start to think, when you learn about people afterwards, it adds an extra layer to the onion, doesn't it, really? But what I was about to say was this album actually went down better in the US than it did in the UK. Now, what is all that about?
Well, all things British, I suppose, you know, it's like one of those...
Because what had happened is that there were two singles that they pre-released from the album. There was Driving, which they released in the June, and Shangri-La in September, and both the singles failed to chart.
No.
Yeah. So in the US, they released this song, Victoria, as the lead single from the album the same week they released the album in the US.
Mm-hmm.
And it went into the charts at number 62 on the Billboard Hot 100 charts. And of course, well, it had been 3 years since they'd had a top 20 hit with Sunny Afternoon.
Mm.
So they're really relieved they hit America. And yet they were releasing singles off the album and they weren't charting. So off the back of that success, they released Victoria, and it went to number 30 in the UK charts. Isn't that funny? So sometimes it's just odd. You can have a song that will connect in a different culture, in a different time, whatever's going on.
Well, they made more money in the States, of course. Oh, yeah. So, but Dave Davis, the guitar player,
yeah,
you know, he was always Skeeter, you know, supposed to be really good. I never really got him, but there was a big controversy earlier on in their career when somebody said that Jimmy Page actually played one of his solos. And I just can't remember which track it is, I should know, but it's just disappeared out of my head. But it was like, oh, the huge controversy about that and stuff. And,
Cliff and Egg.
Yeah.
Well, this album as well, you know, this Arthur album, is a concept album. It was actually originally, it was going to be part of the Granada TV had commissioned a programme. And he wrote this album to go as the soundtrack for this programme.
Is that right?
Yeah. And they got so far down the road. I mean, this has taken me ages to look at and it gets very complicated. But they got the director and then they pushed back the times and they spent a good year on it. And anyway, at the end of the last 11th hour, it got cancelled.
No.
Yeah.
And they've written all the music.
Yep, so he just went ahead and released it anyway. So that was quite interesting. So you've got this kind of concept album coming, which is written in tandem with the visuals. You know, it's going to be part of a greater, more 360 media kind of experience.
Yeah.
So that's why some people say...
2018 thing to say, Ali.
Yeah, 360 media. Yeah, but they were saying, but it was like Arthur is by all odds the best British album of 1969, they're saying. And it shows that Pete Townsend still has worlds to conquer and that the Beatles have got a lot of catching up to do.
Blimey, I'm not sure they agree with that. One thing I want to say about the vocal on is that if you listen to the first few lines, to me it sounds a bit like Jimi Hendrix singing.
Really?
I think so.
And guess what else I thought?
Go on.
I can hear a bit of, you know, Ian Dury in those lyrics, the way that they're going California, and the way that they're like from Bombay to...
Well, there you are.
I just suddenly had this little vision. What's going on? Because I never get these kind of comparisons normally.
Well, you know, they're all influences that these guys had, so...
Yeah, get in there.
Betty came by on her way, said she had a word to say about things today and fallen leaves. Said she hadn't heard the news, hadn't had the time to choose way to lose, but she believes. Gonna see the river man, gonna tell him all I can about the plan. If he tells me all he knows about the way his river flows and all night shows in summertime, said she prayed today for the sky to blow away or maybe stay. She wasn't sure, for when she thought of summer rain calling for lost the pain and stayed for more. Gonna see the river man, gonna tell him all I can about the band. I'm feeling free. If he tells me all he knows about the way his river flows, I don't suppose
Drake and Riverman from his debut studio album Five Leaves Left, which was released on the 3rd of July in 1969 on Island Records.
Yeah, and recorded at Sound Techniques Studio.
That's, hello.
Yeah, and John Woodhouse engineering it, who's a mate, of course, of Andy Seward, who we saw last week.
Ah.
Yeah, and Sound Techniques, they have their own desk and everything. They had and they're really particular about that studio. In how they designed it. And apparently, Nick Drake, on that particular track, sat in the middle with a microphone, his guitar, and all the string people around him, you know.
Oh,
and
wow.
He recorded it all simultaneously. And that is brilliant. No overdubs, nothing. And that most of that album was done like that. Amazing.
Do you know what Nick Drake wants? I want to lie on a riverbank with his music in my ears, close my eyes, and just feel the countryside, you know. I just want to disappear with Nick Drake.
Marvellous songwriter, marvellous British, you know, one of the cream of the British, you know.
It's sad though, you know, that he was largely undiscovered and went largely unnoticed when he was alive, you know. And they always say with hindsight, well, at least people are getting his music now and it's actually out there a lot more.
Yeah.
But he was petrified of playing live. And I can really relate to that, you know, because I've had a big battle myself. You know, when it comes to like when I started learning bass, I used to just wanted to look at the drummer. It was really weird, you know, how I had to break through that.
Well, I think especially, I mean, you're used to it being a folk musician, but I mean, you know, me, an acoustic guitar and a voice,
naked.
It terrifies me, even now.
Oh, you know, and I'm so emotional. This show has been so evocative of so many emotions. But it's the end of the show. We've got to close it off now with our last song. Yeah, we do. So thanks so much for joining us for this week's episode of the Superdome Show. And if you want to get a hold of us, we're on Facebook and Twitter at Susie and Simon.
And if you want to listen, we are on Mixcloud, Spotify, iTunes and iHeartRadio. So please tell your friends.
Indeed. So what we'll do, I think we're going to play more Nick Drake. We'll talk about Nick more later on in future shows. But we're going to play you out with a band called King Crimson. Cool name.
Yeah, Robert Fripp, another progressive rock combo, you know. Robert Fripp leading it with Frippatronics and his fantastic guitar playing. And Greg Lake, of course, singing that went on to Emerson, Lake and Palmer. And you can tell it's him. And it's a great song. I mean, you know, it's one of the classics of all time from that era.
Well, it's weird, you know, because it went to number 5 on the UK album charts. It was number 28 in the US. So it really connected. And it was recorded on a 1-inch, 8-channel recorder at Wessex Sound Studios.
Yeah, through an Eve. So there
get in there. And guess what? I love the title of this. It's from an album, by the way, called In the Court of the Crimson King. It was released on the 12th of October. So we look, 1969 again. I don't know what's going on here.
And a totally bizarre and beautiful album cover. One of the most iconic you've ever seen.
That's mad, isn't it? Well, this is a 21st century schizoid man.
Scream for me. get sun.